Active with Midlands 183, powered by HereMed Healthcare in the heart of Tullamore. Here when you need us. HereMed.ie.
Last Sunday was my greatest sporting achievement ever at the Mullingar Half Marathon. I ran the furthest I've ever done in my life. And of course, it took weeks and weeks of preparation and training and, as you might know, ups and downs. But it was a fantastic day. But this week, we have to run further and longer. So no rest for the wicked. 2 days later, back to the gym.
So just went for an easy enough cardio workout. 30 minutes on the bike and 10 minutes on the cross trainer. Warm up, cool down. Feeling stiff since Monday. Thighs are a little bit stiff, as you would expect. Hips a tinchy bit as well. But every other muscle seems to be doing well. Everywhere else seems to be okay. No injuries as such. Just a bit of stiffness from running, which is to be expected. But all in all, oh God, I'm just so happy with it. No injuries, no knocks. It's the best I can hope for. The absolute best outcome.
On Wednesday, for me, it was rest day. On Thursday, myself, Will Faulkner, David Hollywood and Rose Multiney from HereMed in Tullamore, our wonderful supporters here on Get Active with Midlands 103, went for a recovery run.
So we're still getting active.
Barely.
Just about. We're getting there. We're on our way to HereMed in Tullamore.
There's a bridge.
Oh, no. Do you know, hills, I think we'll walk this one. What do you think?
Push.
Give me a piggyback. So we're getting active with Midlands 103 and follow our journey online and all the socials as well. And don't forget, we're doing all this for Barristown. It's a great cause. So please give generously if you can.
So here on Get Active with Midlands 103, we're getting to crunch time now as we face the marathon in less than 3 weeks. And one thing I've learned over the last number of weeks is the importance of psychology in sport, definitely when running a marathon, because it does test you at times. And I'm delighted to be joined by sports psychologist Keith Begley. Keith, thanks for coming in for a chat.
My pleasure, Peter. Glad to be here. Thank you.
Keith, is psychology in sport important?
I suppose it is. I mean, some people would have the perspective that it's, you know, a little bit out there, a little bit wishy-washy, but I mean, psychology is central to everything we do, you know, because if we're thinking about anything, we're applying psychology. So in everything we do, whether it's getting up in the morning and going to work, you know, there's elements of psychology being applied. I suppose the context is the level of the specificness or application of psychological principles. Is that important? And it really is, in terms of if you think about maybe there's some people might be familiar with the term cognitive behavioral therapy, cognitive psychology. So there's an element of that which we would talk about, how you controlling how you think influences controlling how you feel, which then influences how controlling how we behave. So if we so think, feel, behave. So if we can control how we think, we can control how we feel, and essentially that has impact then on how we perform, our behaviours that come out of that. And that's, I suppose, widely speaking, is used around diet and nutrition and weight loss, or, you know, maybe giving up smoking or alcohol, or behaviour change, if you like, for want of a better word. So in terms of sport, it's the same thing. You might be moving from, in your case, in this case, you're moving from someone maybe who wasn't overly active to trying to become, you know, I suppose not an elite level athlete, but, you know, trying to perform a task that's very, very physically demanding. And there's behaviour change needs to happen in between for to get the outcome. So if we can control how we think, you know, on a regular basis around our diet and nutrition and preparation, and because how we're thinking, we feel a little bit better and more proactive around it. We're a little bit more active, and then the behaviours, then we're able to do the actions as an outcome. So essentially any performance task like that, psychology is central without even realising.
It's probably, as you say, without even realising, it's something that was always there, but it was never highlighted in sport. But we're highlighting it more now and now.
Yeah, I suppose in the last probably 8 to 10 years, in terms of high performance sport, the presence of psychology has become more prevalent. Certainly in mainstream sport, it's kind of seen as acceptable, whereas I suppose a number of years ago it might have been seen as a little bit taboo, and the teams or athletes might have been considered mentally weak if they were utilising a sports psychologist. But there's no doubt, I mean, it's gone back for years and years. I mean, Liam Griffin famously in 1996 was utilising a sports psychologist, and that was in Ireland. That was probably a catalyst moment for I suppose acceptance of sports psychology in terms of what Wexford did and winning that All-Ireland, and many teams since have been using it. Some people talk about it, some people don't, or some groups talk about it, some people don't. But I suppose it over the last, like I said, 8 to 10 years, it's probably there's more acceptance towards its importance firstly, and its use secondly.
And your job is to work with athletes and get the best out of athletes. How do you get the best out of athletes from a psychological point of view?
I suppose how you do it then is you flip the thing. I suppose traditionally in sport, you'd have this an old school kind of authoritarian sort of approach where the coach says and the athlete does. So if you flip that over on its heels and you look at it, from the perspective of what does the athlete want to achieve? And then as a sports psychologist and maybe in around a coaching team, your job or role then is to facilitate them being their best. So if you look at it from a psychological perspective, there's a concept called self-determination theory. So how you get somebody who is really self-motivated to optimize or maximize their own potential. So there's three central kind of components to that. And the first part of it is autonomy, which is that the athlete kind of owns the thing, if you like. So they're deciding the terms in which they engage. Now, if they want to achieve, they're going to engage at a very, very high level. But in essence, the coach or the psychologist is then, because they feel they own it, they're getting higher levels of engagement rather than feeling maybe compelled to do something because the coach or manager is instructing them
telling them to do it. Yeah,
sense.
Yeah.
All right. So when the athlete then owns the goal, they're more engaged and more motivated to engage with the process that involves getting them better. A second aspect of that would be competence. Okay. So competence is that we're asking them to operate within their stretch zone. So for example, if I'm asking someone who is, let's say, who wants to lose 5 stone in 3 weeks, it's not possible. Okay, so it's not within their competence range, if that makes sense. Now, if you were to ask someone to lose 6 pounds within 6 weeks or 4 weeks or whatever, it's within their stretch zone, if that makes sense. It's doable, but it's within their stretch zone. So you're asking them then to do tasks that's within their competence. Now, if they feel like they have ownership of it, and they feel that they have, that they're able to, it's within their competence, they're likely to, I suppose, stick it out and engage with it. And if you do a review then maybe 5, 6, 7 weeks later, and you're trying to get another, set another goal or another target. So it's a consistency around maybe setting new targets, getting improvements, setting new targets and getting improvements. And that's kind of how it works in terms of, I suppose, setting targets that are achievable targets so that you can improve your fitness levels and performance and skill levels and everything and anything performance related.
That's interesting actually, because I remember, God, about 20 years ago I joined a gym and I said I should probably join a gym to be healthy.
Yeah.
And I lasted a month.
Yeah.
And the reason being, looking back now, is because I had no goal.
Yeah.
I just went to run on a treadmill and on a bike, but I had no goal to focus on.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and I mean, that becomes the driver. So you think about, you go back to the first thing we talk about, think, feel and behave. So if you have a goal and you're aiming for something, so in your case, you're looking to run a marathon. So that's your objective. You have a set target. Now you're more likely to engage with the process of getting there, if that makes sense, in a short term. And if you're doing that then consistently across time, you're moving from being able to run 5K to being able to run 10K to 15 to 20 and so on and so forth. So, it's getting that consistency. Look, there's an element of dedication involved, but if I feel it's my target and my goal and I have autonomy around it, then I'm more likely to engage. And that's how you kind of facilitate. It's what we call an athlete-centred approach, if you like, which is I suppose, considered best practice.
What athletes have you worked with in the past, Keith?
Without naming names, I would have worked with international athletes in boxing, athletics, swimming, rowing, plenty of inter-county hurling senior football teams. So Offaly, Carlow, would have done a lot of work with Coola and different teams like that. That's you know, I wouldn't mention necessarily individual athletes that might come to you. I suppose primarily GAA teams, a couple of soccer teams here and there, and a couple of rugby teams here and there, but primarily GAA and individual athletes. Then you could get a wide range of anyone who, you know, from archery through to whatever, you know, whoever rings you, really, you know.
It's interesting you mention archery, because we were fascinated watching Luke Littler recently,
yes,
at the darts.
Yeah.
And okay, some mightn't consider darts a sport.
Yeah.
But I presume the same psychology applies to darts as it does to 100 metre sprinting.
Yeah, in terms of attentional focus, darts would be very much what we would call an accuracy-based sport, okay? And what you'll see is, like, I would work with a lot of athletes who would suffer or struggle with performance anxiety. Mm. So the ability to execute their skills under pressure. So someone who's able to do it really, really well in training, and then they go out in a championship match and they're rattled with nerves, and they might be, say, for example, you're a free taker or a penalty taker. So skill execution under pressure, and they struggle with that. So darts is what we'd call an accuracy-based, very much an accuracy-based sport. So you could equate that with the likes of golf, okay, really sharp, refined accuracy. You could equate it with, say, a hurling free taker, a football free taker. You could, snooker would come under that sort of, I suppose, type of skill, if you like. And just, I suppose, in around that, performance anxiety, so the ability to control your nerves under pressure is central, whereas I suppose sprinting would be run as fast as you can from A to B. So what we would say, it's a power-based sport.
Okay.
So yep. There's subtle differences, and a lot of, I suppose, the work that I would do then might be working with athletes around how they can control their attentional focus and bring down their anxiety and get them relaxed so that they're then able to execute their skills under pressure, if that makes sense. And to best describe it, I suppose, if to relate to it, if you think about, for example, famously, the English football team, penalty shootouts, and you have professional players who struggle to hit the target from 12 yards, you know, and likewise, you could argue golf, you know, when, you know, famously, when Rory McIlroy is coming down 2011, coming down the Masters, coming down the backstretch, you know, the last six or seven holes, and any amount of players have struggled with that, because they struggle to, I suppose, in skill-based sports, execute their skills under pressure, and no less in the darts with Luke Littler the last day, before Christmas there, or at Christmas, if you like. The game was there for him, he was in control, and again, your nervous system goes over into overdrive, and you know, you struggle to execute your refined skills under pressure, which can be a struggle for some.
You mentioned their anxiety or performance anxiety in sport. Mm. When you think about sport, let's say 30 years ago, let's say intercounty game, you know, you've guys going out performing in front of maybe 1,000, 2,000 people who showed up. But now it's not only the people who see you on the day, it's social media, it's videos that get shared, it's people with their own opinions.
Yeah.
And that goes from, you know, small scale to large scale as well.
Absolutely.
Have you seen a rise in anxiety linked to social media and sport?
Hugely. Particularly in young athletes, what I found is, I suppose, in the last 3 or 4 years, there's an awful lot of young, I suppose teenagers presenting with performance anxiety, and some of it possibly around social anxiety as well, and it's manifesting itself in sport. But I definitely think the whole kind of TikTok generation, and the kind of, if you look at it kind of in a broader perspective, everybody is a journalist now. In the lives of, you know, when we were young, you might get your picture taken at a communion or confirmation or a funeral or a wedding, you know, typically. Now it's every day, it's all times every day, and for young people, there's a camera always nearly within, you know, striking distance of them. And I think there's a kind of, suppose, there's an awful lot of perfectionism tendencies out there, which kind of, I suppose, lends itself to higher levels of anxiety in general, which then feeds into sport, if you like, you know. So it's certainly, yeah, with younger athletes and older athletes, performance anxiety is an awful lot more prevalent because, you know, even we'll say inter-county GA teams and that, the message boards and all the, you know, everyone can be writing comments about whatever is going on or not going on. That facility didn't exist 15, 20 years ago. So the only thing that I suppose was written about it was what was in the Sunday paper on a Monday morning Monday morning paper after, you know, whereas now it's way more invasive, if you like, you know.
What does it take to become an elite athlete? Like, if there's a young person listening to this right now thinking, I would love to become an elite athlete, from a psychological point, what do they need to do?
I suppose, firstly, to a certain extent, it depends on the sport, okay? And the first thing is you have to have a body or body type that's suitable for... So, for example, there's only a certain cohort or percentage of people in the world who can compete in 100-metre sprinting, for example. Whereas if you take, say, for the likes of marathon running, it's probably accessible to an awful lot of people, you know, in the sense that your aerobic capacity, it's an awful lot easier to get to a level of running a marathon than it is to get to a 100-metre sprint final, if that makes sense. So your body type, so that's the first thing. From a psychological perspective then, beyond that, you're looking at, I suppose, consistency of application, an element of dedication. I also think that enjoyment is a huge important factor. You have to enjoy the sport of what you're doing, because if it's not enjoyable, or the dynamic around it is not enjoyable, you're not going to stick with it.
Definitely. Yeah.
You know, I think that's the first thing. You have to want to do it. And beyond that, then, I suppose, application around best practice in terms of your diet and your nutrition and your hydration, and living, and willingness and wanting to living the life of a serious or elite level performer. So everything that goes around that, diet, nutrition, hydration, and so on. And then the application and consistency to do it time and time again, you know?
Yeah. Talk me about the link between psychology and nutrition. Because, you know, to feel good, you have to eat good. Yeah. And, you know, to be healthy in the head, you have to be healthy in the gut as well.
Yeah, I suppose they're very much intertwined. So, like, I mean, if you go back to the first thing we talked about, we'll say the CBT aspect of think and feel and behave. So if I control how I think and I control how I feel, I control my behaviour. So in around food, I suppose, if we control how we think around food, you know, so sometimes when we're not eating healthy, it's because we're kind of, maybe some people were, because they're punishing themselves, you know, they might gorge on something for a spell, or they might binge eat or whatever. But so if we control how we think around what we want to do, that influences how we eat, because we want to eat properly, because we want to eat well, because we want to be able to perform, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So it's very much intertwined. And then, you know, if you're to look at it, beyond that CBT element of how controlling how we think around it, if you look at maybe the likes of goal setting, so you might set yourself targets around, say, for example, you want to eat a certain volume of carbohydrate or a certain amount of protein if you want to put in muscle or put on muscle or whatever. So depending on what you want to do in terms of your sport, you can use psychology principles, just basic simple goal setting, to, I suppose, influence what you're eating. So you might set targets around increasing protein intake if you want to increase muscle capacity, or, you know, if you want to increase your hydration levels, you might set a goal around, for example, basically simply drinking 2 or 3 liters of water every day. That's simple, you know. So you write down your little goals. It might be, I will drink 2 liters of water every day, starting with a pint of water for breakfast. and you have your bottle filled, and you have that, and that's part of your day, and it's at the door when you're heading out, and you bring it with you, and that then influences it. Now, if you don't write down them goals, it may not necessarily happen. It might just happen by fluke, or not happen, or you won't get, at least you may not get the consistency of behaviour, which then you don't get the consistency of having the hydration levels at which you want, if that makes sense.
It sounds like you're training yourself almost when it comes to nutrition, but the same approach you would with training.
Absolutely, yeah. So that goal setting concept can apply to anything. So very simply, like if I was a footballer or a runner or anything, I want to improve my skill. You know, if I want to work on my weak side, what am I going to do? So am I going to set time aside? It might be 15 minutes on non-training evenings, for example, to work on my weak side, for example, as a hurler or as a footballer or a soccer player or whatever it is. And I might set myself then challenges within that to know that I'm getting a little bit better, and then maybe set harder little challenges. And if I'm doing that on a consistent basis, then my skill level is improving. And the same thing would apply then to improving your fitness levels, or improving your nutrition levels, or improving any aspect of performance, really.
Mm. Again, the psychology has to be behind that I want to do it, that I've set this goal to do it.
Yeah. Exactly. And when it's athlete-centred and they have autonomy and they're involved in the deciding of the goal, then they're doing it because they want to, because they own it, as opposed to you're being told. So, for example, let's take a GAA scenario, and a manager or a coach comes in and he says, right, no drink for the next 6 months, right? Or, you know, and it's an authoritarian sort of top-down approach. And what that does is it generates resistance, in which case you're less likely to get the outcome that you want. Whereas if the athlete is more involved in the deciding of the goal or the target, that's where the thing
flips. They're involved in it.
They're involved in it. They own it, as opposed to they're being told to engage with it, if that makes sense.
100%, absolutely. Yeah. So one of the things we wanted to do by putting together Get Active was, we had a look around to see if there was any maybe podcasts or anything like that people could follow. And there was nothing really to take somebody from zero to marathon. Mm. So this is why we put Get Active with Midlands 103 together. So if there's somebody listening to this right now who's thinking to themselves, I wouldn't mind doing a marathon someday, what is the psychology they need in order to run a marathon? Is it a different kind of psychology?
No, it's very much just the application of them principles. So let's say, for example, they're able to run 2 kilometres. So what are they going to do to extend that? So they might set a couple of targets, a couple of goals to say, we'll say, let's say, for example, within 2 months that they'll be able to run a 5K. OK, so what are the actions they can do today, tomorrow and the next day, over the next, say, 2-3 weeks, so that in 3 weeks time, they're further on towards running a 5K? And what are the actions they need to take around their nutrition and their diet and their and hydration and their physical, I suppose, capacity to do that? OK, so small steps. So we would call that basically performance oriented goals. So little actions and steps that you can do so that in 6 weeks time, you're a little bit further down the track. And you might revisit that then if you're able to run a 5K and you want to run a half marathon, for example. The same principle applies. What are the little goals and actions that you can do to extend the 5K towards, let's say, 15, 16, 18K, so that you're able to get to that half marathon stage over the next, let's say, 8 to 10, 12, 14 weeks? And consistently reviewing that. So obviously you've done the half marathon now at this stage. So now you're at the point and you're saying, right, what can I do over the next, say, 2 weeks so to get myself into shape to get to the marathon stage? So if you're doing that on a consistent basis across time, you could move from, we'll say, within a year from running your first 5K to running your first marathon if you really want to.
You normally set out a plan. Mm. But sometimes the plan doesn't go to plan.
Yeah.
So how do you motivate an athlete when things aren't going so well? Like, I never realised the psychology behind having an injury in sport until I suffered one myself. And I have a lot of sympathy for anybody who suffers an injury in sport. But how do you, because there are times, there are weeks, there are days where you kind of go, the world is against me here. Everything that can go wrong is going wrong. How do you pick yourself back up off the floor?
Yeah. So again, I suppose similar principles. You know, it sounds very simple, but it's similar. So, you know, if you have an injury, what can you do to try and speed up the healing process? You know, is there, from a cardio perspective, for example, if you're, let's say your ankle is injured, or let's say whatever, can you do something else aerobically to allow yourself to get that aerobic training without necessarily taxing your ankle or whatever is hurt? So could you do hit similar kind of times and physical exertion levels, for example, on a rowing machine or on a bike or on a cross trainer?
Okay, exactly, so what I've been doing over a 6 week period.
So there you go. Yeah,
when I injured my calf muscle. That was it. The cross trainer, bike, rowing machine.
So low impact stuff. You're still getting the aerobic benefit. And you know, whatever part of your body is needing to heal, you're facilitating that. And then the same thing would apply around setting goals around your diet and your nutrition and your hydration, and when the injury does come right, that you're ready to, you're at a higher level, if you like, than you would be if you just disengage, and then you're almost nearly back to or close to square one.
Yeah,
you know, so it's a similar principle. It's applying of a similar principle, I suppose, short-term goals. What can I do today, tomorrow, and the next day, and in the next week, so that in 10 days, 2 weeks' time, I'm a little bit further on?
100%. Patience is a big thing as well, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's known, I suppose, look at it, you know, if you're engaging with a physio, or if you're engaging with people that are helping you around your injuries, and they're giving you instruction to what not to do, and then you know what you can do, and you're working around it, and I suppose you kind of navigate your way through it, and at some point, hopefully, your injury clears up, and you're aerobically, then you're a little bit further on for having done the extra little bit of work in a different vein, but nonetheless aerobic work, because I suppose marathon is all just aerobic work. So you know.
So we have less than 3 weeks to go to the marathon. What do we do at this stage from a psychological point of view? I mean, we've built up a lot of work. How do we focus ourselves to get to our end point at this stage? What advice would you give me?
I suppose, firstly, if you're to go back to just that old simple goal setting process, right? So what can I do around really working on my energy levels? Okay, so I might set some goals around sleep. I might set some goals around nutrition and hydration. I might set some targets around my gear. What kind of gear? So look at it in a marathon scenario. It's kind of nearly almost blister prevention and different things you can do around irritants that might be unhelpful on the day. So from the type of socks and shoes you're wearing, to the types of clothes you're wearing, to types of whatever shorts you're wearing, and so on and so forth. So try and get that right, and have a little bit of a plan around that, and I suppose engage with people that know. That would be a big help around that. Physically, then you're looking at, I suppose, following your plan or whatever it is, you're looking probably to get up to maybe 70 or 80% of a marathon before you'd run it, and obviously having to affording it the weight it needs to be afforded in terms of having the energy to do it. So you can't be training really, really hard up to a marathon. You have to down, maybe you have to have a down
taper
week
off,
taper
yeah,
off
yeah.
so that you have the energy, and you know, maybe do a little bit of reading up on carbohydrate loading, so that you have enough energy and how you're going to fuel your run, you know, around a little bit of preparation around maybe different gels or isotonic drinks or food or whatever you need to do on the day. And there's loads of information online around that. And then within the marathon itself, you know, very often you'll go in and you go to the marathon and your adrenaline is up and you're pumped and you're all guns. And sometimes for some people, the trick is not to go too quick, you know, because you're full of beans and you just want to go all, and you run the first 10K too quick, and then the juice is gone, you know. So you've got to be very careful around that. Know your limit and know that it's a marathon, not a sprint, literally. Mm-hmm. And within that, then I suppose the back end of the marathon, probably the second 20K or maybe 25K for some, is probably the harder part. So to come back to the attentional focus part, I would have done stuff with runners before, and what they might do is to have a little maybe attentional focus cues that they might use at the start of a given kilometre. So a little bit of a confidence boost along the way. So something along the lines of, you know, come on, you can do this, or come on, Peter, let's go, or you
like
know,
a little mantra, or
a little mantra to yourself,
And right,
you know, if you know, you come across, we'll say, maybe a 20k marker or a 25k marker, a 30k marker. You might, or maybe there might be individual markers along the way. It might run up in ones, but there will be markers along the way. And if you just have a little mantra of arms are strong, you know, arms are strong now. So the idea is that the rhythm of the mantra would marry with the rhythm of your running, if that makes sense.
Oh, okay.
So if you were just to say that to yourself maybe 5 or 6 times, you know, legs are strong now, legs are strong now, legs are strong now. You're almost nearly kidding your body that you're kind of, you know, you're still on track.
Okay, right.
And a little bit of a kind of a confidence booster, like, you know, come on, Peter, let's go. Or come on, you can do this. Going well. This is great. You know, you frame the narrative to yourself.
Okay.
Right. And what that does then is it flips your thinking from, oh, Jesus, how long more have I to go, to think, feel, behave. Yes, my arms are strong. I'm feeling a little bit better. And then you get the performance outcome because it's a little bit of a boost through the course. You're dripping sort of, if you like, positive affirmations into your thought processes through the course of it. So rather than thinking, geez, I'm really struggling with this.
Yeah.
You're kind of feeling, yeah, I'm still going here. I'm going to do this. Come on, let's go. You know, so it, in and of itself is energizing.
I found early on I was nearly punishing myself where I was going, right, but that's 10K. I feel exhausted after this. I'll have to do 3 more of these on the day.
Yeah.
How do I avoid punishing myself?
Yeah, so you're kind of, again, that's kind of self-doubt and a kind of a pitiful narrative you kind of that comes in on you sometimes when you're tired and fatigued. I suppose if you know you have the work done and you feel more in control because you have a kind of a go-to thought strategy, like just the one I've just used, that you know that, you know, when you're getting to the 20, 22, 24 and the higher up kilometres, if you like, or miles, you know that you have a go-to strategy that's going to pull you through. That in and of itself will give you an element of kind of confidence and resilience. And it's a pursuit of resilience, really. I mean, marathon is tough. It's a tough ask. But, you know, if you pitch the narrative to yourself that you can do it, and it's what we suppose in psychology perspective, it would be known as positive self-talk or instructional self-talk. So you're instructing yourself that your legs are strong now.
Yeah.
And your arms are strong now. And it's that kind of, if you like, flipping the narrative to feel you have energy, so that then you have energy and you might be getting a gel or a bit of an isotonic drink along the way and you're feeling, you know. And another thing to do is maybe stick in with someone. You know, it's a lot easier to do it, you know, pick in with someone, that you have someone there that's in your view line, and you know you're just going to tag along with them.
Right. Somebody of a similar similar
someone
pace.
Who's just ahead of you. And don't think, you know, forget about, get away from, you know, your position. All right. Get away from, you know, I'm coming 1,000 or 2,000 or whatever it is. If you can just think about, you know, you're doing this because you want to do it.
Yeah, true.
And you're doing it because you're enjoying it. And isn't this great? I'm running around Manchester feeling like a king here. And, you know, these people are here to see me and embrace the situation rather than kind of poor me sort of mantra, if you like. Because that can then kind of bring down your energy levels, if you like. And you're feeling a little bit kind of, you know, less motivated, if you like, you know.
I often think that when I'm running and you meet somebody else running on the road and you go, God, they're running much faster than I am. Or even during the half marathon last week. But what I kept telling myself was, that's not my race. Yeah. This is my race. Absolutely, they're running their own race. Yeah. I'm running my race.
Yeah, yeah. And you probably have, most people who run in marathons, they might have some form of smartwatch and they can gauge their time or whatever, you know. So like, you know, we would say swim in your own lane, you know, run your own race.
Exactly, exactly.
You know,
yeah.
You're not in a race against anyone else. It's a challenge in and of itself to get it done.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the challenge. The challenge is to do it. And if you can, you know, just take it piece by piece, 3-4K at a time, and utilize them, I suppose, little mantras along the way. I mean, this stuff would have been used at Olympic level in terms of people running or involved in distance or endurance events. You know, so these little just self-talk cues or mantras that you'd use to try and keep themselves in that kind of vein of consistency across the, I suppose, towards the back end of of the event, you know.
Yeah, I get you. Keith, if anyone's listening now thinking, I could do with a coach like that, I could do with a sports psychologist for me or for the team, how did he get in touch with you?
Yeah, so you'll find me on Twitter, performancepsychology.ie. You'll find me online. You'll find me on Facebook, Performance Psychology Ireland. So, social media, it's not hard to find. A quick Google search, you'll find it handy enough.
Brilliant. Keith Begley, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Peter.
I run the marathon to the very last mile.
So what I've started to do on rest days is I've started to take up yoga. 30 minutes stretching, just following a video on Facebook that's specifically for runners, but I really, really feel the benefit of it.
Here we go. Curl the left toes under if they are not already. We're going to lift the hips up and back. Rocking onto the right heel. Big runner stretch here.
So a few days ago, there I was doing my yoga in my sitting room. Went from the cow pose to the downward facing dog, the camel pose, the one-legged pigeon. Yeah, they're actual poses. Feeling good, nice and stretched out. And then you had to do what's known as the happy baby pose.
Happy baby pose. So we reach around, knees go wide. We grab.
So the happy baby pose is where you lie on the ground and you grab the outside of your feet with your hands and you roll around like a baby.
Give yourself a big hug, roll around a little bit.
So there I was, rolling around like a happy baby. I looked up. And all I could see was a delivery man looking in the window of my sitting room. I kid you not, there I was rolling around. And he goes, I have a box, I'll just leave it here at the door. So by the time I could explain, I was actually doing yoga. It's one of the poses you have to do. He was back in the van. So God only knows what the poor man was thinking. But look, lesson learned. Next time, close the curtains when doing yoga. So you never run a marathon before you run a marathon is what we're always told. So the time had come, the peak of our training, the longest distance we had to run before the big day in 3 weeks.
So this day last week was my longest run ever, 21 kilometres. And we are just approaching 28 kilometres. And we are at 3 hours, 15 minutes on the road. How are you feeling, Christy?
I found today tough. I struggled a bit mentally to get going at the start, but once I settled into it, it wasn't too bad. But yeah, look at LOL, you have to take the good days with the bad, don't you? So.
True. I mean, let me just describe it now. It's nightfall now at the moment. It's 7 o'clock Sunday evening. We started off our run just after three, about half three, I think, about 25 to four. So, you know, Chrissy, you done a day's work before doing 28 kilometres. So it's not like you wake up fresh in the morning and run. You've done a day's work. And for myself, we went for a leisurely stroll with friends this morning. Well, I thought it was leisurely. And then we watched Bose on my wrist before lunchtime and say, congratulations, you've done 10,000 steps. And I thought to myself, oh no, to do 28 kilometres after doing all this. So there must be some benefit to running later on in the evening, having been on your feet a good bit. It has to be worth more than just doing 28 kilometres, is it? Or am I just making up excuses?
I don't know. I'm going to go with you because I have a bit of mileage in the legs already, say, no more than yourself. So, yeah, it's. I'm hoping it does anyway.
Yeah, hopefully. That's our story and we're sticking to it.
Absolutely.
So Chrissy, this is the longest run we're going to do before the marathon. So this day, 3 weeks. We're going to have to take it easy for the next while and taper it down a little bit.
We would have liked to have done a longer run maybe last week as well, but look, as we did the half and whatever else, so look, we can only go with what we had, and we've had injuries and whatever else, so now it's time to recover the legs a little bit, but we'll still do probably 20k next week, and then maybe back to maybe 8 miles, so about 13k then the following week, because that'll be just resting the legs, and at that stage, then, as you said earlier on, you're just trusting your training, then you have to take strength from what you've done, and you know where you've come from and everything else, so that'll be about good nutrition, good hydration, and we'll be good to go.
So we're about 14 kilometres shy of a marathon now at the moment. So I'm kind of hoping that with a bit of recuperation and with a bit of a buzz on the day,
we'll find it in the legs.
Absolutely, yeah. Look, we're after doing 5 laps in the Greenway, 4 laps in the Greenway. Yeah, 4.5 laps in the Greenway, maybe 5. So, like, there isn't a sinner around. Yeah. You know, last year was a 400,000 people packed the streets of Manchester. So, yeah, there might be a small little difference there.
One or two.
Just one or two, yeah.
So we're going to head into the week, and we're going to recover tomorrow, get a few runs in during the week, and then a short long run, and then the following week, same as shorter long run, and then a build up to the big one. And hopefully we stay injury free, illness free, and we can continue to raise as much as we can for Barstown as well.
Absolutely. But you never thought 20k would be a short long run.
A short long run, honest to God.
We sound like runners.
Yeah, we sound like we're imitation runners.
Yeah.
And we're doing this all in aid of a fantastic charity. They're Barstown Children's Charity, and we can't do it without your help. Please, please, please donate what you can on Midlands103.com. Click on Get Active with Midlands103, and that'll take you to our I Donate page, or you can find it on our social media pages as well. And when you donate €10 or more, you're in with a chance to win a year's membership for the Unit Gym in Clara or a signed Manchester United jersey.
Get active with Midlands 183, powered by HereMed Healthcare in the heart of Tullamore. Here when you need us. HereMed.ie.